You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 94. No one has a job in our business until you type the end. James V. Hart.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie is going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Now, before we get started, guys, I wanted to let you know that, as promised, I am launching a huge Black Friday, Cyber Monday sale for the rest of November. It will end on November 30th. You're getting up to 70% off all the courses on IFH Academy, including our formatting and story development courses. And if you're into distribution, film producing, if you want to produce your own scripts, how to network, how to build a career in the film business, we got a bunch of new webinars and online courses to help you on your path. So if you want to take advantage of that, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/Black Friday. Now, guys, today on the show, you are in for a treat. We have an epic episode today because I have the legendary screenwriter, James V. Hart. Now, if you're not familiar with James's work, let me just lay out a couple of his credits. Films like Hook, directed by Steven Spielberg, Bram Stoker's Dracula, directed by Francis Ford Coppola, Contact, directed by Robert Zemeckis, as well as Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, Tuck Everlasting, Sahara, Laura Croft, Tomb Raider, August Rush, and of course, Muppet Treasure Island as well. He has done so much in the business and has worked with some of the most legendary film directors of all time. And I was so excited to have James on the show, because one thing I've never actually said on the show was that Bram Stoker's Dracula is one of the major influences in my filmmaking career and is one of the reasons why I wanted to become a filmmaker. And James brought that film to life with the legendary Francis Ford Coppola. And we go into deep stories about how that movie fell off the rails a bunch of times and what he developed to not only save that film, but to help other screenwriters help them with their emotional pulse of their screenplays. We also talk about Hook and how he came up with that idea with his six-year-old son, and how Spielberg got involved, and Robin Williams and Dustin Hoffman. And we go into his amazing story mapping tool, the Hart Chart, which is a system that he created working with Francis Ford Coppola on Dracula to kind of track the emotion of your screenplay. Now, as you guys know, I've talked to a lot of people on this show with a ton of different story systems and techniques and methods to get to the story. But what James is presenting in this episode and what he's presented with the Hart Chart is really revolutionary. And it really does make you look at your story completely differently. It is pretty remarkable what he's done, and I cannot wait to share this episode with you. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with James V. Hart. I'd like to welcome to the show James V. Hart. How you doing, James?
So far, so good.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I am, as we were talking a little bit before we started recording, I am a huge fan of many of the movies you've done. You kind of were there at the beginning of my journey as a filmmaker with Hook and Dracula specifically, and we'll get into all of those as well. But I mean, you've done a lot, sir, in your tenure in Hollywood.
I did have a little help,
along
pretty substantial help.
Yes, exactly. And it's and of course, everyone always looks at your careers like yours, like, oh God, he just started off with Spielberg. I'm like, no, he was hustling a little bit prior to Hook.
I was 44 years old. I was the overnight sensation that had been standing in the corner for 20 years.
Exactly. Yeah. So let's get into that. How did you get started in the business?
Well, I grew up in the 60s. Went to film school at a nondescript film school in Texas. And I had always, my dad was a big drive-in movie guy. So he was always throwing us in the car and popping popcorn and going to the movies. And we had a place in Fort Worth called the Gateway Theater. So on Saturdays, my mom would dump us there, 25 cents. We got 2 features, 5 serials, 100 cartoons, and we spent the whole day at the movies. And then we'd go home and reenact the films. I didn't know how to get in the movie business. And then we started going as teenagers on Friday night, where it got really interesting. But I became obsessed with films from a very early stage. And my parents, to their credit, never talked me out of it. And we didn't know. So, I mean, I went to SMU, which had no very little known film school, but a gentleman named G. William Jones, the head of our department, brought in some of the hit relationships all over the country. I mean, George Roy Hill came to you in 1969 with a Wet Gate answer print. Bet you don't know what that is.
A Wet Gate answer print. I actually shot film back in the day, so I'm aware.
A Wet Gate answer print of Butch and Sundance.
Wow.
Nobody had seen it. There were just 30 of us. We spent 5 hours at George Roy Hill after watching the movie discussing. Alan Pakula brought Stir Cuckoo. Dennis Hopper and Jack showed up with Easy Rider. And I watched, every co-ed in the room sign Jack Nicholson's arm with their phone numbers. So we didn't have, we couldn't text in those days.
Right.
So we didn't know. I mean, we weren't UCLA. We weren't, NYU or any of the big film schools, but we had this amazing access. I mean, Robert Altman brought MASH to screen.
Oh my God!
At SMU, and it saved the film. They were going to dump it because they were doing Tora or some big. They were just let his and the reaction in Texas at our film festival changed the course of that film.
Wow! Yeah.
So I didn't know how blessed we. I thought everybody,
Had Robert Altman and Jack Nicholson and Dennis Hopper walking,
and you hang out with them and stuff, and we made films. We made narrative, 30-minute color films at SMU in this nondescript film school, and decided that I didn't go to Vietnam. I got lucky, and I just told my mom and dad I wanted to be in the movie business. They said okay.
And this is the time. When the movie business. That wasn't even considered a career. Like that's not a thing.
to the 60s and 70s were exploding in the indie film world. And actually, right. I have to point to L.M. Kit Carson, who came to. I know you. Kit was one of the leaders of the indie film movement. I mean, David Holtzman's Diary sort of set the standard. The Jim McBride film changed everything. Kit was a journalist and also wrote criticism and everything. He was an amazing person. He got Wes Anderson started or was part of nobody starts Wes Anderson, but he was part of that. So he came and lectured at our class that we only had 15 students in our film class. There were 30 in the department.
Right.
We were the wind up Bolexes,
Mm-hmm. Oh, I remember.
And Kit came to show us David Holtzman's Diary, which if you haven't seen is an incredible first kind of mockumentary or first kind of documentary that wasn't really a documentary. And I asked a few questions during the session. And afterwards he said, come on, let's go have coffee. And he took me to on the campus there, and we went to the student center and had coffee. And he basically was saying, this is what you're going to do. You're going to write. And in those days, you didn't think about being a writer. You thought about being a director, mm-hmm. a director, a superstar, you know. And Kit was right. He sort of outed me and got me thinking about the possibility. And especially Coppola had started Zoetrope. Mm-hmm. There was independent film. Dennis changed the world with Easy Rider. 5 Easy Pieces, Bob Rapelson. I mean the Monty Hellman, you know, were these groundbreaking directors that were doing stuff their way. So my friend and I got in our van. We sent our movie to Francis Coppola, American Zoetrope, and we drove to California in our van. And we went to Los Angeles and knocked on the door there at TBC at Rapelson's production company, met with him, and then we drove up to San Francisco and sat in Francis Coppola's office reception room for a week.
What? Really?
Every day we're the guys from Texas. We came here to see Mr. Coppola. We sent him our film, you know. And the Dragon Lady, of course, said, "Well, you know, he's really busy." And this was a great. This was the very beginning of Zoetrope.
Had THX been released yet? Had THX been released yet or not yet?
Just released. He was doing Rain People.
Right. So
George Lucas would come in and out. You know, there was an who did the thing? The director who did Right Stuff.
I know who you're talking about. Yeah, I forgot his name.
San Francisco directors, that whole crew was in brilliant cinematographers, Caleb Deschanel, you know, in and out. And we sat there all week going, "We're back," you know. And she, "Well, you know, he's really busy." I've told him you're here, you know. And finally on Friday, we didn't get the hint, you know. It was like, finally she said, "You know, he's leaving for the weekend. He's really not going to be able to see you." And we said, "Well, we'll come back Monday." And she said, "Well, he's going to be gone for a very long time." So about this time, I see through the little glass hallway portal window, you know, here comes Coppola. And he had the Jerry Garcia hair in those days.
Yeah, yeah.
And he opens the door and walks into the reception room. We get it, Mr. Coppola, we're the guys from Texas. And I know the Dragon Lady's behind us going, you know. And Francis doesn't say a word. He just wheels, pivots, and heads right back through the door. And waves at us over his shoulder and says, "Keep making movies." And Stephen and I went, "Wow, Francis Coppola just told us to keep making movies. Wow." Not knowing, of course, we were being completely blown off. And Francis did get Stephen, my partner then in filmmaking, a job on a Roger Corman film that was shooting in Texas. So he did come through. But years later, when we were doing Dracula, I told him the story. And he said, "Do you know how many guys like you showed up in my office?" I have no idea. I can't remember a thing about this. You know, like, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Coppola. Thank you.
But
thank you so much.
That gave us the bug. We went back to Texas and said, "Francis Coppola said for us to keep making movies."
Which wasn't a lie.
Yeah. So we raised money in Texas and shot a film in Europe that Leon Capitanis directed, who if you Google him, you'll find out who he worked with, great directors and comedic directors. Got in a lot of festivals. Mm-hmm. Brought it out to L.A. to sell it. It was when Dirty Harry was popular. We were doing a European-style movie about two hitchhikers from North Carolina hitchhiking around Europe during the summer and what was happening to them. So we're more like Truffaut. Mm-hmm. We didn't have any killings or car chases or –
right.
But it won a lot of awards at festivals, and even Peter Goober saw it and said, "I hope my first movie is this good." So we kept being encouraged. We kept being killed with kindness, you know. And I didn't start writing until I wrote in high school, but I never didn't know it was a job. We were raising money for another couple of other bad Texas films that were nightmares. And the scripts kept coming in, and I kept going, this is not good. So my friend Bill Kirby, William Chamberlain Kirby, the name of the rose that he wrote, he did Hallie. He wrote Hallie Ashby, wrote Stuntman, a bunch of stuff. He was my mentor.
Wow.
And we started writing together. and wrote several scripts that never got made, but they gave us a profile. And the first script I wrote by myself, I put another name on it. I was embarrassed that anybody would think that it was called Frat Rats. It was basically Animal House before Animal House and became a big lawsuit. But I put a name of a person on it I hated in college. So, you know, they're sort of in my disguise. And then people would give me criticism not knowing it was me, which was a huge help. And yeah. it also taught me to be developing a thick skin, you know.
Okay.
And not react. But I started writing and got a couple of blessings. Got hired to write my male cheerleader story, my Texas experience, which is a terrible film, but gave me a chance to get produced and find out what it was like to get paid to write, because that's when it changes.
So,
you know,
so
when they pay to write, that's when it changes.
You know, absolutely. Then it becomes serious. Like, oh my God, this is real. Yeah. I remember when I got paid to direct, I was like, oh my God, this is a thing. I can actually do this. I'm not actually paying for the privilege of doing that. Someone actually is paying me to do it. So, okay. So from your male cheerleader Texas movie, which I'm assuming that was
give me an F.
Yeah. That's what I thought it was. Give me an F. I'm assuming that's give me an F. From what was the covers, like something from Beaver View Beaver View or something like that. It's like, oh wow, I saw that. I was like, yeah, well, hey, you know,
when I wrote it, I wrote MASH for girls.
Yeah,
the producers got a hold of it and went, we can't do that. We can't make this movie. We have to do tits and ass and you know and all that.
Yeah, of course.
And
of
so
course.
I watched the movie and I just go,
oh god,
that was my last comedy.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
What I wrote was really savage and the way the girls talked and the way they thought.
It would be more kind of like Fast Times in Ridgemont High, because that was it was funny, but it was actually really raw and really authentic. But the producers.
Or Slapshot. Language in Slapshot. That's when I saw that, I went, hey.
There it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right. So you go from your male cheerleader movie. How do you go from there to working on Hook?
There's
a big jump there. Because in the IMDb, your IMDb, there's a big gap from 1984 to 1991. And I'm sure some stuff happened there, but I'm really curious on, you know, it doesn't have to be the whole story, but just how did you get into the office and how'd you get that gig? Because I'm assuming in 91, this is pre-Jurassic Park. So I know during that time, my time frame, I was worked in a video store from 87, 88 to about 93. So during that,
Kevin Smith.
Yeah. Kent Tarantino, Kevin Smith, all that. Yeah. I was that time period. So in that time period, I'm pretty much excellent in trivia. Like I know all the movies that got released during that time and you made a bunch of them in that time. And I know from my recollection, Steven had already had a couple of, he was always Steven and he was always a hit.
Yeah.
But a lot of people were saying, oh, it's over for Steven. You know, it's great. He hasn't really had a big hit in a while. This is Schindler's List and pre-Jurassic Park. But Hook was a big deal when it was being produced. It was like everybody wanted to be on the set. It was huge. How did you get that gig?
Well, it wasn't a gig. I created it. My son at age six at the dinner table, he's now my writing partner, said, what if Peter Pan grew up? It was a game we played, what if game. I was a very successful development deal writer who wasn't getting anything made.
But making a living.
Walk in and get a development deal.
Right.
You know, made a living, put kids through private school. And my son would come home and say, Dad, everybody wants to know what movies you've made. And I couldn't point to give me an F. So I went and said, I showed him the wall of scripts I'd written. I had written for Spielberg. I'd written for Frank Marshall. I'd written for Robert Redford and Paul Newman to reunite. I mean, I had some very prestigious gigs. None of them got made. So when it came time for – I decided that there were two films that I had to make, Dracula and Hook. And I was actually fired by CAA and let go because I hadn't had anything made and I was in my 40s while I was writing Hook and Dracula.
Yeah.
Dracula was set up as a USA movie for television with a budget of $2.5 million.
Okay.
And dear sweet Karen Moore, who we're still friends today, paid me to write that script. At the same time, I was working with Craig Baumgarten and Adelson, Greg Adelson, on a development deal at Sony. And they came to me and said, what do you have that nobody wants to do? I had tried, I had pitched Hook all over town. When my son gave me the idea, mm-hmm. and my daughter now was part of that. She just directed her fourth film. When we came up with Hook, it was blasphemy. You know, you were treading on sacred ground. You couldn't have a grown-up Peter Pan. Stephen was trying to do Peter Pan, but Michael Jackson. Coppola had tried to do Peter Pan. Jose, there's a bunch of people had wanted, but John Hughes wanted to do Peter Pan. They all kept coming up with the same idea. The Darlings go back to Neverland, or the Darlings' children go back to Neverland. It was always the same story. And it wasn't until Jake said, and then during our What If game, you know, Dad did Peter Pan grow up? And I said, of course he didn't. You know, that's a stupid question, being the good parent that I was. And Jake said, yeah, but what if Peter Pan grew up? And boom, the bells and whistles went off. We pitched it all over town. Everybody passed on it. Finally, Craig Baumgarten said, what do you have that nobody wants to do? And I gave him my 10 pages on Hook. Brought in Nick Castle, who I adored his film of The Boy Who Could Fly. We made a low-ball development deal with Jeff Sagansky at Sony TriStar, that, as a favor. Nobody gave a shit about what we were doing. So Nick and I went off for a year and smoked cigars and drank single malt and took the idea of the story from, you know, what was the worst thing I could do to Peter Pan to grow up making me a lawyer, you know? So we spent a year on the script just having a ball. Sagansky leaves Sony and Robert and Mike Medavoy comes in. And usually, whenever you know the drill, the studio head changes and everything.
It's tainted. It's tainted. Yeah, it's tainted.
It didn't work for you. Mike Medavoy reads the script and goes, wait a minute. This is huge. And I don't know this is going on. I mean, I'm trying to pay the light bill, you know? And so Medavoy got together with CAA and they went out to five directors over one weekend. And I still don't know who all was on that list, but I know most of them. And Stephen was the one who said yes. And my wife always knew that if Stephen found out about Hook, that he would do it. Because it hit all of us right in our guts. We were all fathers. We were, you know, Dustin was older, he had kids. Robin was turning 40, he had kids. I mean, Stephen was having a new family. You know, everybody suddenly had that father thing going on, mm-hmm. and that responsibility of what happens when you grow up and you've forgotten your childhood. So we were actually in Wyoming, staying with friends. We rented out both of our apartments. We had the kids, you know, and I was trying to hope that my credit card worked to pay the lunch bill at Cadillac Jack's. And in those days, we didn't have cell phones. I had to go downstairs to the payphone, hope my credit card worked, and check my answering machine. Remember answering machines?
I do, sir.
Hi. And there was an answering machine from John, the message from John Levin, who's been my agent at CAA and still is in my representative for like 35, almost 40 years. He said, call me. There's a very big director that wants to do Hook. So I called him. And we spoke, and I said, if it's not Spielberg, we're not having a conversation. And he went, that's who it is. So I went back upstairs to my kids and to Judy, and who were all sitting there, you know, trying to figure out where we're going to go next, and gave them the news. And it was, you know, it was a tremendous, it was like, you know, it's one of those Hollywood stories, you know, you just, it happened. And And I had written the script long before Spielberg was involved.
Right.
It was still an issue, you know, that so much creativity. I mean, I created Rufio. Mm-hmm. You know, I created that whole multiracial lost boy thing. We had Wendy grow up, we had be old. You know, we did all the stuff. Actually, there's a lot more Barry in the script than there is in the Disney version. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it suddenly everything changed.
Of course.
Nick, it was difficult to watch Nick be replaced because we both worked so hard on this. That's why I insisted he get story credit. But within the same period of time, I turned in Dracula 6 weeks later. Now, this is an agency that fired me.
And were they representing you at this point?
I asked them to please stay. I said, I'm writing these two scripts. Well, nobody's going to do those. Just represent me until I get to that point where I'm done. Then you can cut me loose. And my lawyers tried all over town to get me. Nobody even wanted to represent me, you know, while I was writing these scripts.
Right.
Dracula had been done 100 times. Nobody was going to do Dracula. Nobody wanted to do Grown Up Peter Pan. And to John Levin's credit, John Levin took Hook to Dustin and Robin. And they went to Steven.
Oh, that's how it went. So it was through the actors, yeah. And they went to
exactly.
Smart.
Exactly. And John Levin went to Winona Ryder, and nobody could believe she wanted to do Dracula. And she's the one who called Francis and said, "Will you read this script for me? Because I need to know if something. I want to play a grown up, you know."
Right.
Plus, she'd stuck it to him on Godfather 3 by walking out the door, and we got to meet Sophia.
Yes, I remember, of course.
So in a matter of 2 months, I went from the abyss to the two biggest directors in my world wanting to do two scripts that nobody wanted to do. Everybody passed on. So I didn't handle it very well. I was, you know, all these agents suddenly call you back and go, "Hey, we were just kidding, you know." All right, I didn't make the decision. It was somebody else's decision. And I'm just going, you know, I'm the same writer I was when you –
we're going to dump
didn't
me.
Want to represent me. So I'll stick with John Levin.
You know? Yeah, that's amazing.
And that's how I got the gig. I watched two of the greatest directors in the world struggle. I had such admiration for what they had to go through to get those movies made.
Because because Hook was a challenging film to make. It's and technically and creatively, and I mean those sets. I remember hearing stories of everybody in Hollywood had to make a trip to the set because the sets were so amazing, and it was a tough sell too. I personally loved Hook, and I thought it was amazing, and it gives me warm feelings inside every time I watch it, and now more than ever because now I'm that 40 something with kids. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I loved it when I was 20 something, but now it completely has a completely different connotation now. Like, oh wow. Shoot. It's a completely thing.
So now your kids see it.
And now my kids see it and all that kind of stuff. But then with Dracula was that first film. I remember seeing Dracula in the theater opening, and it was a huge opening. I remember it was because that
saved Francis's life and set records. Nobody could believe how big it opened.
It was, and it was, if I remember correctly, one of the best trailers I'd ever seen.
Sid Gannis.
Oh my God! What a trailer editor! I mean, because that trailer sold the movie so beautifully.
Yeah.
And the way Francis went about it with this whole old kind of like turn of the century style filmmaking and using older technologies and reversing the film. And it was just so rich and the transitions and how he was able to do it. But you were telling me a story before we started recording that Francis made a phone call to you. Can you talk a little bit about that?
When Dracula sets were being built, when Hook was coming down, so it was kind of a heady time for me. But we were deep in post-production and had a release date right around Halloween in 1992. And Francis had been in the editing room nonstop. And we'd had two or three disastrous previews. I mean, just disastrous. And I watched this courageous man go, "Oh, well, it's another rewrite. Let's go back," you know, and just the studio is panicking and they're wanting to shut it down and come and take over and what have you. So it was about late summer. We're opening in October. Mid to summer, I get a phone call at midnight in New York from Francis. And when, you know, Mr. Coppola calls, you wake up. And he said, Jim, I want you to get on a plane in the morning and come out here as fast as you can. He said, I hate the film. I hate the script. I hate you. I hate the fact that you ever wrote it. I hate the actors. I hate the studio. I hate the whole idea that I ever got involved in this piece of shit. I want to show you that movie.
Wow. Great sales pitch.
Yay. I can't wait. So the next night I'm there and I'm in San Francisco and to Judy, I don't know how long I'm gone. I don't know what's happening. I don't know if this is a day trip, if I'm being fired, if the movie's, you know, I don't know what's happening. So the next evening, I'm down in the Godfather screening room there at Zoetrope, as Francis called the Bohemian Amblin. You know, the big, big Godfather couches and cigars and wine and liquor, and two women that spoke Romanian. I don't know why they were there, but there were these two women. I think they were, you know, bite my throat or something. And Francis didn't even come down. He called me from the penthouse. Okay, good. You're here. You're fine. You know, okay. All right. Said, I want you to call me after you screen the movie and I'll come down and we'll talk. This is about 10 o'clock at night. So by 10:30, I'm drunk. By the time the film is over, I'm so angry. I'm so pissed. I mean, he was right. He was a piece of shit.
Wow.
You know, and I had been to all the dailies. We rehearsed. We did this incredible prep that he learned from him. All the prep he did.
I saw. Yeah.
All, you know, the storyboards that we did. The screenplay was lauded by the actors. You know, there wasn't a bunch of people saying, this sucks, throw it out. They wanted to add more. And I'm going, how did this happen? So then Francis comes down in his dapper, you know, we're smoking robe and a cravat and stuff, little pointed Turkish shoes and, you know, and all happy and said, you didn't call me. I said, yeah, I hate you too. I hate it too. So he said, let me tell you, like a big kid, the film I wanted, we're going to make. And I'm going, didn't we just make this movie? You know, and he pitched me what I thought we'd shot. But what I began to recognize is that during the shooting, we sat in the next 2 weeks and went through every footage, all the footage we had, and went through the existing cut. And we began to identify pieces of narrative that the film needed. Not whole scenes to be reshot, but pieces, transitions, piece of narration, an insert here, you know. And I kept saying to Francis, there's got to be a way to head this off at the pass so you don't wait until you get the editing room. You fix some of this in the script. There's got to be a way to measure that script and manage that script so it's telling you a whole lot more than – because we thought we were golden. I had the greatest director in the world, and here we are in the editing room panicked, you know. And I said, especially because indie filmmakers don't have the money to bring back, you know, Winona Ryder and Gary
Oldman, Keanu,
and everything, you know, they don't have that kind of money. They're in the editing room going, we're fucked.
Right.
So this is where the heart chart came from. I'll just give you an example of the, we didn't shoot any new scenes. We shot pieces. We realized that we had never seen Dracula and Mina together. I mean, his wife together before he went to battle. So when she hands him the helmet, you know, and he goes off to battle, the ending was the big controversy because the ending didn't work. The ending, she stabs him and plunges the knife into him, and she's redeemed, and he dies at peace, and he's redeemed. And then she walks out the door and walks into the arms of Keanu Reeves, and the audience was like booing.
No.
And I kept saying to Francis, "That's not who they want to see. They want to see Winona and Gary stay together somehow
forever."
Yeah, forever. So he had George Lucas and Mike Minghella, Hellboy, watch the film to see. Yeah, we'd done a cut. We spruced it up, and we told them where we were going to fill in these blanks and that sort of thing. We got to the ending, and George said, "You broke your rules. You don't have the right ending. She has to cut off his head, which is the rules you set up in the film to totally redeem him. She's got to complete the mission, and then not walk out the door." And Keanu Reeves' arm. So I remember Francis calling me, and he said, okay, George saw the film, and he thinks that, you know, we got to do this. And he said, do you think we can, you think Winona would, you know, come back and work with Gary if she could cut off his head? And I said, I think that's the only way you'll get her back.
Because
legendary. Not getting along, you know.
Yeah, they had a rough time on that set, from what I heard. Legendary.
Yeah. So we came back and put that chapel scene back up together. He had built all those sets like theater sets, so he could just fold them out. You know, it's incredible.
Wow.
Save the gargoyles. So in that last scene where you see all of that seamless work, some of the close-ups and some of the wide shots are shot a year apart. And you're seamless. They had to do wigs. They had to do all this stuff, you know. And she cuts off his head. And then Roman came up with the idea of the beautiful mosaic in the ceiling of them together, you know, flying together. But I kept saying there has to be a way to, in the screenplay form, while you're doing the script, to measure these emotional journeys your characters are going on and how to head some of this off of the path. We should have caught the fact that she had to cut off his head. You know, if we'd followed the emotional journey of what Carrie always had to do to Sadie by cutting off her head and taking out her heart, you know, if I'd been measuring that emotional journey instead of just, it had been a great scene, you know. So he said, well, why don't you start with these three questions? And he gave me three journalist questions, which was the beginning of the heart chart. And the questions were very simple. He said, just answer those three questions before you start anything again, before you start a story. And so I started using the questions, and then I expanded them to 10 questions, and I started drawing these charts, these actual hand-drawing charts to measure the heartbeat and the emotional journey of the characters. Not an outline, not cards on the wall, because even cards on the wall, I get lost. Mm-hmm. Where am I emotionally? Where am I pace-wise? How important is this? So the chart was like your EKG when you get your heartbeat. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those of you who are old enough to do that. And so we started out by drawing them. That's the Austin Film Festival, one of the very early charts.
Yeah, I see it.
And then in 2015, Guy Goldstein came to me, who did Writer's Duet, and he said, I can do an app. So now we're an online app.
Right.
That is the Dracula chart, the very first chart I ever did.
Okay.
And there's the drawn one. So, and I started doing it at the Austin Film Festival every year, but doing my films. And then people said, well, you wrote those films. You did that on purpose. And they went, ah. So we started doing other people's films. So I've done Jordan Peele, Get Out. I've done Jamie and Zaziel's La La Land, Bo Burnham, Eighth Grade, the Wedding Crashers, mm-hmm. you know, Batman. I mean, suddenly you start applying these principles to it. And if you just follow this, you'll never face a blank page. You'll never be writer's block. I don't believe in writer's block. Mm-hmm. My daughter just said it yesterday on her podcast. She doesn't believe in writer's block either. That there are ways, if you know craft, you're always jumpstarting. You're always writing and answering questions and solving problems. So the heart chart is my booklet. Mm-hmm. It used to just be printed up and given away. That's how thick it is. How thick is Robert McKee's book?
A bit thicker.
And how much dust is it collecting on your shelf?
A lot.
Yeah. Chris Vogler has the only book that's as thick as McKee that should be used. Now, listen, McKee did a lot for the screenwriting trade.
Sure.
You know, this is all you need. And it says right there, never face a blank page again. You have some shitty ones, you know, but you won't be blank. So they finally begged me to put this together at Austin, and we just started it about 3 or 4 years ago, and it's caught on. And the app, the chart you saw, is now available online. And it's an opt-in, opt-out. It's a monthly subscription. And it saves everything in the cloud, every version you make, every change you make. If you go to the website, you can see the examples and you can see it come to life. I needed it because it showed me an emotional journey, what was pulling my characters through the narrative instead of being pushed. And that's what I'd been doing up until Dracula.
You'd been pushing.
I pushed everything. And even Hook, I learned a lot on Hook of finding character. If you do this, you will be writing character-driven narratives as opposed to plot-driven. It's even now being used by some showrunners and TV where they can take the chart and do a whole season.
Mm.
You know, it really lets you see on one page the emotional journey your characters can go through instead of an outline. You know, now there's a lot of work you do before that. I mean, there's a lot of writing you do before you put it on the chart. But those three questions that Francis gave me is where this all started. I went, oh my God. And people go, oh, that's easy. You know, what does my character want? What do they need? What are they afraid of? What is their visible, tangible goal? Is it a satisfying ending? Because the biggest one for me is, do you have a satisfying ending? Not happy, not sad, not good or bad, but have you satisfied your audience with the journey you've taken them on? And I know everybody's got plenty of movies and TV series where they didn't like the ending of the series, or didn't like the end of the season, or they didn't like the end of the, you know, like Lost. Or
yeah, so Lost is a bad –
or, you know.
Well, a good example of a movie that – a show that did had a horrible ending that people hated was Lost. But another – a great one I feel is Breaking Bad. Like Breaking Bad's ending was perfect and satisfying. Yeah, totally. And like Vince did a perfect job. And that was a lot of weight to carry, because he was so good. Almost every episode of that series was amazing. And it just kind of kept growing growing.
Yeah.
And if he missed the landing, the whole thing comes crashing.
Like Sopranos, the last episode of The Sopranos, you know.
Mm-hmm.
People like, or the last, even the last episode of Game of Thrones, people pulling their hair out. So these are all things that I think you can, Vogler and I both agree on this. There are certain storytelling principles in the ether of the universe you can't fuck with.
Yeah.
You can try and they're going to get you.
Right.
Or you can learn to manage them and use them to your benefit. Like structure for me is not a formula. Structure for me is lightning in a bottle. It'll actually liberate you if you know structure. So my whole thing is about structure and about character-driven narratives, it's the only way I've survived. It's not one of those things where I'm a working writer. I use this every single day in my craft. I'm adapting a book right now for Scott Winant. That's how I adapt. I actually do notes.
Well,
and I'm using this. I use these principles, these questions, these signposts in every single thing I do. And you'll see some quotes from some pretty big writers that didn't want to know about it until they saw what I did with the chart. And they went, oh my God, you know more about the movie than I do. You know, and I directed or I wrote it. It's great for threshold writers. It's a lot of writers that are struggling to try to figure out how do I get to be that?
Mm-hmm.
I've seen them stop in the middle of my sessions and go and solve a problem and come back and say, I just solved it. You know, I know what I'm missing. Well, and it's, I want it to be mechanical, not some, you know, spiritual guided talent that you can only have if you're special,
you know,
that it really, that there really is a mechanical process to what we do as writers.
I literally just had Chris on a couple of weeks ago, because it was 25th anniversary of Writer's Journey.
I was on the tribute. Yeah.
Yeah. I love Chris to death. And the one thing I was talking to him about in regards to plot and character, because that's always a lot of people are like, oh, I'm plot first only. It's, oh, I'm only character based, or theme and all that. And people just try to pigeonhole themselves. But the one thing I think it was him, or I think it was another guest that I spoke to, but this concept of all the great movies, what do you remember? Do you remember the plot or do you remember the character? Like, I vaguely remember, I've seen all the Indiana Joneses. I remember Indiana Jones. And I do remember some parts of Raiders of the Lost Ark's plot, like quote unquote plot, but I remember Indiana Jones. So characters are what we don't identify with plot as a species. We identify with other human beings, other characters.
The characters, yeah.
And that's what you connect with. Like, you connect with Andy Dufresne in Shawshank. You know, the plot is the plot is fantastic, and but it's all about his experience in that.
Yeah.
Did you ever heart chart Shawshank?
Yes, I did. Frank and I go way back. We did Frankenstein together. That was the last film he didn't direct.
Uh-huh.
Frank talks about Shawshank in a very interesting way, because a lot of writers don't want to know about structure and don't want to know about, they want to be taught. They don't need it. They don't have to learn anything.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank says, we'll tell you that, hey, I wrote Shawshank in 5 weeks, but he thought about it for 8 years.
Yep.
Yeah. So when he sat down to write, he had figured all of this out in his head structurally, character wise, where he needed a scene and why, you know, so he did his chart in his head. Frank doesn't need my help. There's a lot of writers who do need this help. It helps a lot of threshold writers get off the dime. And I have writers from my Columbia classes that are now on directing and running companies and stuff, and they still teach the heart chart, you know, to their incoming writers. Shawshank is probably one of the top 10 movies
ever
on anybody's list. Yeah.
Oh, it's my number one. I mean, everyone in this,
look at it. It's character, but it's also incredibly well structured.
Oh, I mean,
when Gil Bellows gets shot, you know, you had to structure that character up to that point where you could not afford to lose him. And that's the point of no return. When he's dead, all bets are off.
You know, right.
A different ball game.
Right. Because we're like, he's going to get out.
There's hope. Oh, he's got a hope. There's hope. And bang, pulls you right down the chart. You're up here going, okay, there's news. He's going to out him. You know, he's right down here.
And then, of course, makes the villain, even that much more villainous. And like, it completely just cements him as the absolute pure personification of evil. And by the way, that move that the end, and by the way, anyone who hasn't seen Shawshank, sorry, spoiler alerts on all this. But if he does that, and you want to talk about satisfying endings.
I mean,
that is a satisfying ending. Yeah. Seeing him do what he did, Clancy Brown's character get taken off. And then he's going to basically deal with whatever he was dishing out for the last 20 years himself now as a prisoner. Yeah. And then just that beautiful ending. Please tell me if this is true or not. The original ending wasn't what Frank had in mind, from my understanding. The studio executive said, no, they need to meet each other on the beach. And that was added after. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Because that ending was...
I do think, well, and that's when the footage began. I mean, I don't know where they came up with that, whether they came up with it in the editing or at script stage. If my whole theory is you should be able to figure that out in the script stage. You're always going to learn something new from the footage. But if you track that emotional journey of those two characters, they have to meet on the beach. They have to.
And now when you're saying so can I just kind of dive in a little bit deeper into the heart chart? Because when you're saying you're tracking the emotional journey, what is exactly the heart chart doing to the character's emotional journey? Like, how are you tracking this? Because it sounds fantastic, but physically, like technically, how is it working?
I wonder, I don't know if I dare, I was going to try to call up one and show you. By answering the questions, you get a series of pluses and minuses. This is good for the character. This is bad for the character. This progresses the character. This is an obstacle that stops the character. This decision this character makes is going to have a consequence. Is that consequence good or bad? So you begin to measure ups and downs.
Got it.
Setbacks, successes. I have a signpost I call the top of the mountain. And I have another one called the Cinderella moment. I have another one called resurrection opportunity. These are terms that nobody's heard before. I have veteran writers go, I've never heard of a resurrection opportunity. What a great, you know, and then where it goes and why. Top of the mountain, what I began to learn through fairy tales and really good narrative was that there's a top of the mountain dead center in your narrative where it's as good as you're going to get. It's a success that your main characters have had or something they've accomplished where you're going, yes, they've done it. Now,
is it,
and
Chris where is
Vogler, it? And Chris Vogler, his center is the ordeal.
Right.
You know, my ordeal is over here, a little deeper in. But top of the mountain is become a term now, and it's how you structure the first half of your story.
But this is the
top of the mountain.
But is the top of the mountain in the first act, second act, third act?
No, dead center, middle of the second act.
Okay.
Middle, so is that and even if you do five acts, doesn't matter. It's the dead center of your narrative. And I begin to measure certain films and look at them and go, wow, I'm right. The good Indiana Jones, the primo Indiana Jones.
Oh, yeah, Raiders of the Lost Ark, yeah.
Literally, 1 hour into that film, he's got the ark, he's in the truck, he's got the girl, he's on the boat, he's about to get a back rub, you know, and boom, the movie's not over. Everything after that is a serious complication to whether or not he's going to make it or not, or whether he and Marion are going to survive, or how they're going to get to the end of the movie, you know. And same thing in Dracula. I went back and looked at Francis Cut, and I timed the Rules Cafe scene where he gives her the diamonds and the tears, and they actually meet, and he takes her back and connects with her. 1 hour and 4 minutes into a 2 hour and 7 minute film, and that's as good as it gets for them. Everything else after that is complicated, and everybody's trying to pull you down the mountain. Cinderella, which is where this started. Cinderella, she goes to the ball. Everybody wants your phone number. You know, the prince goes, I'm not dancing with the sissy uglers anymore. Who are you? you know, she achieved her goal, which was in the real story, was to get to the ball and plead to the prince for her father's estate to be given back to her. The Disney-fied version and made it, you know, I want to get married to a handsome prince. Right. But that's the top of the mountain. That's dead center in the narrative. Then what happens? Oh, damn, she stays too long at the ball. Point of no return. Can't be undone. You know, consequences. Plan falls apart. You know, the end of the second act, she's back home to change the toilets again. You know, she's never going to get out. Resurrection opportunity. Oh, there's this glass slipper that she doesn't know about. It's circulating right. town looking for her. Resurrection opportunity. It gives your character that second hope in, for the third act. You know, so, and I begin to measure really good filmmaking and really good film. Even Tarantino is heavily structured.
Oh, see, that's the genius. That's the genius of Quentin, is because his films look like they were thrown together. But even Pulp Fiction, you watch Pulp Fiction, that movie is
perfectly structured.
No, it's insane.
It began to give me the feeling that structure and character go together. They're not competing with each other. They are complementing each other. And if you learn this skill mechanically, it teaches you how to do this. The word teach is wrong. I don't like saying teach. It gives you strategies on how you can accomplish this for your work. You know, and our chart also tells you how long it's been since you saw a character when they entered. Oh my God, I haven't had that character in 30 pages or 15 pages or, you know. So it begins to measure a pacing for you about when your exit stage left, enter stage right. You know, when a character shows up and what the impact is they have on the other characters. Sometimes your characters are going completely opposite directions.
But what I love about the heart chart, and trust me, doing this show, I've interviewed everybody. I've talked to everybody about all their different types of structures. I'm always fascinated when I hear something new that gets me excited, because at the end of the day, we're all trying to get to the same place. Yeah. It's just different maps to the same place. And some people might like Vogler better or Truby better or Hart better. It's all relative. But what I love about what you're talking about is that you can see visually the entire blueprint of your story.
Blueprint's a good word. Or a map.
Yeah, a map or a blueprint of the whole thing. Because the cards are one thing, but you can't physically – you got to go in and read it. Yeah, but visually to be able to see how the emotion of your characters and the emotion of your story is being charted, each one along the way, is fairly powerful. And when you see like there's a dip, oh, wait a minute, there's a problem here. They're flatlining.
Flatlining you don't want to do, you know.
Right. You're flatlining.
Then you're dead.
So that means there's something wrong over here, or I haven't seen this character for a while. Maybe we should bring this back in. That is really fascinating. Can you tell me just the resurrection moment or opportunity in Shawshank? I'm trying to think it in my head. I'm trying to where is that? Because he's lost everything.
Yes. It's when the resurrection opportunity is when Morgan goes into the review that he goes through all the time, and he's been through all of this shit, and you know they always turn him down, and this time he goes and tells the truth. He finally stops lying, and he tells the truth to the committee.
But that's a resurrection for Red. But how about for Andy? Yeah. Or is there none for Andy?
I got to go back and remember the movie.
Because I agree with you. I think that the main character of the movie is Red. It's not Andy. It's Red's, Red's the storyteller. It's his point of view. Everything's coming from Red's point of view. But Andy, you don't see his resurrection moment, because his resurrection moment is kind of shown to us.
Let me think about that, because it could be – because when Gil Bellows' character gets killed, that's like disaster. It's all falling apart. So it's going to come after that. Whatever that resurrection opportunity is for Andy is going to come after that. Mm-hmm. And it may be what prompts his brilliant escape, you know, when he decides to, I'm getting out. So in a way, what he's facing in prison after Bellows is killed, and he knows that he's next. The poster is his fucking resurrection opportunity.
When he clicks off and that first piece of plaster comes off.
Yeah.
But that was years before Bellows.
But he puts the poster up.
Right.
You know. I don't remember when he did that, but the poster, it comes after Gil's death. So whatever it is, it comes after Gil's death.
Okay.
It gives him, where he gets the impetus, I'm getting out of here.
Yeah, and it's so difficult to kind of narrow it down because Red is the main character, and Andy's the back. But we actually the resurrection moment for Andy is actually revealed to us at the end when his entire story is kind of laid out. You're like, oh, that's when it happened. So it's not actually shown to us. But Red, you're absolutely right, and it's tracked so beautifully when he just goes in and just tells the truth. Oh, it's people who listen to the show know my affection for Shawshank Redemption.
And Frank.
And and Green Mile. I love Green Mile. Love Green Mile as well. Now, what is the biggest mistake you see screenwriters make? So you work with a lot of first-time screenwriters. What is the one thing that you see like, oh, God, this is the one thing?
Well, again, that's why I did the toolkit. They don't understand structure at all. They think that it's really not your enemy. It's your friend. And once you discover the structure doesn't make every single film the same, even though the signposts are in my work are the same, you can rearrange them. Can't change A Point of No Return. Can't change Plan Falls Apart. Can't change Resurrection Opportunity. Can't change Top of the Mountain. You know, if you have those four things, you can write back. You go, I try to be unsatisfying ending. Mm-hmm. If you know what those are, you can write backwards. You know what your first act has to accomplish to set you on that journey. The other thing too is I think that they overwrite dialogue and they say they're not able to write behavior into their scripts. They say everything
on the nose dialogue.
Yeah, our exposition all being verbal. So I miss behavior, and executives don't like to read behavior. They like to read dialogue with a lot of white on the page. So tell me what's going on. But good writers can write behavior into their character so that it's like for Indy, it's being afraid of snakes. You know, there's a phobia, you know, that you know is going to show up again. You know that snake's going to show up again. It's just when. So that structure is anticipation. Structure should make you anticipate, not go, oh, okay, well, here comes the part where, you know, the monster's not really dead. Yeah, we know that.
Right.
But it's how it's delivered. And I get my favorite example is I worked with Robin Williams, who was he and his family were great friends. And
I can imagine.
Here. But I watched Robin, the best structuralist I ever saw at work was Robin Williams.
Interesting.
Everybody just thinks that all this stuff came out of his mind. He just pulled it in from everywhere, you know, and all that. And yeah, he did have a great database. But I watched him film live his stand-up show for HBO three nights in a row. And at the end of each night, he would take the card out of his back pocket and he'd start making notes and scratch things out and move, you know. And he would talk to you, maybe you had dinner before or something. He would pick in your brain on something and he would show up in the show. But I watched him rearrange his cards every night, you know, to try to find that smooth ride that he wanted where one thing led to another, but it seemed like it came out of nowhere. You know, and for those that don't believe me, if you've ever seen The History of Golf by Robin Williams,
I love that.
No matter how many times you watch it, how many times you see him do it, same fucking punchline every time.
Yeah.
And you're laughing at all the same places if you've heard it for the first time. That's structure, you know, and all your friends that do improv and bedazzle you with, oh, how do you do that? It's structure. They have a set of circumstances and a set of givens and a set of signposts and a set of circumstances that they always resort to then invent inside that box.
And and that's the interesting, because I know exactly the bit you're talking about, because I piss myself every single time I saw him do that. Thinking back when I heard him doing that bit, which is why did the Scottish create golf, and then the story of the dude that actually creates it, and how he builds stages, sections, and it's plotting. And I never thought about that in joke writing, because I'm not a joke writer or stand up. Yeah. But he actually structured that so beautifully, because when you think he's done, he's like, no, wait a minute. We're going to do this.
18 times.
And then we're going to do – and then they think, oh, yeah, we'll throw it sand in and we'll do this. And then, hey, let's do it 18 times. You're just like, oh, my God, this is amazing. We're going to throw this little ball 1,000 and you're going to feel like it's a stroke. We'll call it a stroke. That's right, because every time you miss, you feel like you're going to have a heart attack.
You can't argue that he makes that up as he goes along, but it feels like it.
That was his brilliance. That was his.
And also, anybody, you know, it's what they say about a comedian. He has good timing, or she has good timing, or she really knows how to land a line, or really that's structure.
Interesting. Interesting. So that, yeah, I had a short interaction with Robin, about 3 months before he passed, and he was such a gentle soul. And I don't know, because you were really good friends with him. There was something I felt off when I met him. I felt this kinetic thing that was coming off of him, even though he was quiet and calm that day. But you could feel that there was this energy. I don't know, maybe it's just me, but he was just like this energy that just kept going. I'm like, oh my God, that must be insane to deal with, because he was that thing that you saw on stage.
But he's actually very shy.
Right. And, he was very calm.
And very quiet and reserved. But if you threw the match in the haystack, you know, he felt that obligation to perform and entertain and make everybody feel good. But I mean, when we dinner with his kids, I mean, the kids dominate the conversation, and Robin would just sit and listen. But he was very attentive that way, and it was the side of him that you don't expect to see. And also, just he had a lot of things going on in his life, in himself anyway. I'll do a Robin story.
Sure, please.
Again, my wife and I were there with them. It happened. You know, what it did never show up in any routine. But and Marcia is his incredible wife with the kids. We're still very close. We went to San Francisco, and I introduced him to Albert Dupontel, a very famous French comedian who he loved. And we all went to dinner at one of their cool restaurants in San Francisco, big high ceilings, and we have a long table, you know, and everybody's looking at Robin, you know, and on the wall, there's a group that are from Texas, or I can say this because I'm from Texas, and one of them had big hair, you know, and they're loud and having a good time. And all of a sudden, Robin would, you know, he would do this a lot, you know, and I watched him looking up, and he was starting to get kind of nervous, and like, he kept looking up, and it was above this woman who's sitting across from us. He kept looking up at the ceiling, and he's going. And we all sort of start sneaking peeks, and there's this giant roach climbing the wall in this super hell damn richy high end San Francisco room. This giant roach, the fucking roach is that big, and it's climbing up the wall to the ceiling directly above this woman's head. And Robin's just going,
oh God, no, no.
Yeah. And we're all going,
oh my God, is it going to fall?
And she starts looking at the table. Like, we're all like, and he didn't want to call the manager over. Hey, there's a fucking roach. And finally it happened. She falls right top of her hair.
No.
Robin falls out. He cannot control his laughter any longer. He is on the floor. He is guffawing. You know, he is sitting where the whole place is lit up. And she's like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And he's like, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to laugh at you. And she stands up and announces to the whole restaurant. She points right at Robin and says, Robin Williams, you're not funny. And of course, then the whole. Yeah. And he bought dinner and everything else, but it was like a sketch out of
Saturday Night Live.
Paralogued comedy. No, something like an old, a Charlie Chaplin, you know,
bit,
you know, and we watched it play out in real time, and it was hysterical. And also, because they left the restaurant, but he bought dinner, and the manager came out and complained, they had a big fucking roach in her hair. They had to get it out, you know, and step on it.
Oh my God, that must have been amazing.
He got on his knees. I'm so sorry. You know, you're not funny.
Which, of course, everybody knows he is.
Yeah.
And was quite funny.
When she said that to him, he started laughing again.
Because he's just like, oh, this is brilliant. I can't write this. You can't write that story.
And to have sat there and witnessed it, I can't believe you. Like, it's going to fall. It's going to land right on her head. We're just waiting.
You know, and it's, I could just, as you're telling the story, my director mind is like, shot here, shot of the roach, shot of the close-up eyes. Like you could just, you're just like, it's a Hitchcock scene all of a sudden.
It is very Hitchcock, you know. And like, and of course, what we all assessed was the roach went up there to commit suicide. It had it. And then dive into a bowl of spray net, you know, and suffocate. Roach, I'm done with this world. We're out of here. We're gone.
And if I'm going to do this, over. I'm going to do this right. Let's go all the way to this.
What's the matter? Did you get tired? You couldn't hold on? You know, when you give up?
Oh, no. I'm sure Robin kept going. I'm sure he kept building up a backstory.
Actually, top of the mountain. and then point of no return and disaster.
That's amazing.
Resurrection opportunity. You're not funny. Change it, Robin. Anyway.
Now
I can work that into a structure lesson. Okay.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. You should absolutely work that into a structure lesson. No question.
I haven't told that story in a long time. Sorry if I digress.
No. I think it's an amazing story. And it actually works about structure. You actually turned it into a structure lesson as well. Now, I wanted to ask you first of all, I mean, you've written all these amazing movies and worked with amazing people. But, I mean, obviously the top of your mountain was writing for the Muppets, obviously.
They were my favorite experience. Brian Henson and I just exchanged notes recently on his birthday.
Yeah.
I guess that's the cat's pajamas or the bee's knees or, you know, the nuts. I mean,
Muppets.
It was totally unexpected. Brian and I had met during Hook and another book that we wanted to do, Paul Gallico's A Man of His Magic, which is a Gallico novel I'm adapting now. Mm-hmm. We'd met and liked each other, and he came to me. Disney was going to pull the plug on Muppet Treasure Island. Mm-hmm. They didn't like where it was going. And they came to me, and Brian said, "Well, you read the script. We're about to lose this project, you know, and we're having problems. Can you just read it and give me some feedback?" And I read it, and there was no human beings in the script. There was no Jim Hawkins. There was no Lon John. So they were all Muppets.
But by the way, for people who are not catching up, you wrote Treasure Island, Muppet Treasure Island. People might not know.
I came in and put my oar in the water with great people like Jerry Jewell and Bill Bottolato and stuff like that. And I read it and said, "There's no humans. You can't make this movie with no humans. You can't have Jim Hawkins be a puppet and Lon John Silver be a puppet. You can't do it." You know, it's like Lucas when he first did Star Wars. They were all robots. You know, and you got to have the human being element. You know,
is that true? Wait. Is that true? When Star Wars, when he first wrote it, everybody
it was C-3PO and R2-D2. They were the heroes.
Okay, right. And then Luke showed up afterwards. Yeah. Got it.
So we woodshed it up at my house and. Up in the Hudson River, which actually Brian's brother lived nearby. We snowstorms and piles of snow. So we spent 3 days working on the script. And the reason there were no humans in the script is that Frank Oz did not like to work with children. He's got 12 of his own, but he doesn't like to work. And so I said, "Well, let me write some scenes and see if we can convince Frank differently. We wrote some scenes and, they loved the scenes because I brought some humanity back into the story, especially the relationship between Jim and Lon John Silver. It has been a seminal relationship in my upbringing about villains. I mean, I have a whole thing on villains, why they're the good guys, mm-hmm. you know? And so it was, we were able to do that emotional connection between Jim and Lon John, keep all the jokes in, keep all the stuff in, you know? But the funny part was casting the Muppets in their various roles because they are like movie stars.
Yeah.
I mean, they were having a hard time casting Kermit. So I would suggest that, and Brian would say, "Nah, Kermit won't play that role. He's not, he won't be good in that kind of part." Oh, okay. And, you know, what do we do with Miss Piggy? You know, she had to have just the right role or she wouldn't do the film. She wanted to pick. Want a bigger trailer or something. So you begin to understand that this world of Muppets is like an archaeological dig. They have a history the way movie stars have a history.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Incredible. And the people that created the character are the only ones who could do them. There was a big controversy when Jim died, if they were going to continue Kermit.
Oh, wow.
So And that's what's interesting. I mean, when Frank Oz's hand goes up Miss Piggy's skirt, he's Miss Piggy. Nobody else is Miss Piggy but Frank Oz, you know. So that was interesting to see that the Gonzo and Rizzo, you know, I can't remember the performer's name, but they were created by the puppeteer, by the Muppeteer. Mm-hmm. So as long as they were alive, they did the characters. You know, then you had other Muppeteers who came in and did ancillary characters. But casting Kermit and casting Miss Piggy was the most difficult part of the show.
Wow.
You know, we made Miss Piggy Benjamina Gunn, who'd been marooned on the island and had a string of pirate lovers, including Long John Silver. And actually, it was fun to watch Frank work on set because he would stay in character even between takes.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I have a better line than that. That's a terrible line. Brian, let's shoot it again.
You know,
who wrote this shit?
And Brian and Miss Piggy would have a dialogue, you know, between takes with Frank as Miss Piggy. Same thing with Steve Whitmire, who did Kermit. They would normally stay in character between takes unless they took a break and shed the, and then when my kids were with me on the set in London, and they're alive. I mean, they don't have eyes their eyes don't move. They don't have, you know, they're not marionettes.
Right. No.
You know, they don't have, you know, and we're leaving the set and we exit the set, are saying goodbye to Brian at the end of the day. And there's a whole trolley full of all the Muppets hanging impaled on their spikes, you know?
Oh my God.
And Julia, who just directed her fourth film, she was, I think, 10 then, when she freaked out, said, "Oh my God, they're dead. You know, I don't want to see this." I mean, their eyes
no, of course.
Were like,
Right.
So it was, and getting to work with Jerry Jewell and the whole Muppet Henson team was extraordinary.
Wow. It must have been so much fun working with them.
Such a culture of caring, and talk about character. You know, I mean, those characters don't change. They're like movie stars.
No,
they
absolutely.
Always play themselves.
My Kermit the Frog I grew up with, which was Jim, and the Kermit the Frog that lives today, the character is the same. All his principles are the same. His Piggy's is the same. Gonzo's is the same. Fozzie's is the same. They're movie stars, but it's fascinating. I just wanted to touch really quickly. You said something very interesting. You believe villains are heroes?
Yep.
Can you touch on that? Because that's fascinating. I'd love to hear your take on that real quick.
Yeah, well, villains are how I made my career. And it all started as a kid when I, again, why is Long John Silver the bad guy? Mm-hmm. Why is Captain Nemo the bad guy? You know, I started as a kid. I mean, wait a minute. Captain Nemo wants to end slavery. He wants to abolish weapons of mass destruction. He wants to end war. You know, I'm voting for president. You know, he's my guy. And then he invents nuclear energy. So far I'm getting people going, good, nuclear energy. Well, no. And then he destroyed nuclear energy because he knew what we'd do, whether we got our hands on it. Mm-hmm. I cried when James Mason goes down with the Nautilus. I wanted to kill Ned Land and Kirk Douglas for throwing the bottles and having him blow up his stuff. I couldn't figure out why he was the bad guy.
Right.
Same thing with Long John Silver. Long John Silver taught Jim Hawkins so much about being a man and being loyal and being a mate. And, you know, when Jim had a chance to shoot Long John at the end when he's stealing the treasure, he let him go. He learned so much from Long John. Same thing with Dracula. When I finally started researching Dracula was a fallen angel. He wasn't a guy in a tuxedo that just wants to suck your throat. There was a story. So villains to me are the villains advance history. Villains force society to change. You know, they force us to advance and to achieve new. And also they're visionaries. We may not always agree. Every one of Jules Verne's The Man Who Conquered the World, you know, all these guys were visionaries.
Right.
John Galt in Atlas Shrugged, the mm-hmm. visionary. Didn't agree with his politics, but he was a visionary. You know? So the villain started jumping out to me like, wait a minute, why is the villain so misunderstood? And so, you know, and then suddenly we now have all, and these were all villains from literature,
mm-hmm.
For me. Jekyll and Hyde is a big one for me. What Robert Louis Stevenson intended. His wife burned his first manuscript. That's the one I wanted to read.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, she burned it.
Why?
I'm sure it revealed too much about them. He led a double life. In real life, he led a double life with his mates. He would take them to London, give them nicknames, give them identities. They'd whore and winch around. Then he'd come back up to his little Calvinist, So suddenly the villain was more interesting to me than the hero. The least interesting character in Star Wars is Luke, till he finds out who his father is. Then suddenly he's interesting.
You're absolutely right.
Harry Potter is another kid who's going to learn bad magic for bar mitzvahs until he finds out who his father is.
Right.
Yeah. So the villain is also what makes you special, and I think Bogler and I both agree on this. It's what forces the call to action. What forces a hero to emerge to the villain. So the hero is really indebted to the villain, and I don't call them villains anymore as much as a nemesis.
Right.
The villains to me sound like a cardboard thing in a video game or mustache twirling.
And that's one of the things about villains that, I mean, without a good villain, the story doesn't go forward. You could have Hercules, but without, all of the perfect example in today's age, Marvel movies. I mean, Thanos was an amazing villain, and that they built it up over a decade of films and how they built that up to the point where at Endgame, when everybody, literally the entire universe, Marvel universe has to come to fight him all at the same. That's why that's such a cathartic moment. Yeah. But that without Thanos, it's just, or if he's a weakling or he's not as, and it's a balance too, because when you have a villain that's so powerful that there's no hope that he could ever be beaten, then it's like, why are we watching this?
Yeah.
That's why
Darth Vader, when you get Darth Vader's backstory, and that's why George did a brilliant job in Jedi, of actually getting to see Anakin, as that gentle older man who you could see as being Luke's father, and even Anakin. I mean, I would do this. I ask this to my students. Why is Darth Vader bad? What did he do that was so terrible? Well, then you go back to the lore, and he went to the dark side to save his wife. He chose the dark side to save his wife's life. That's love. So that also gives you some redemptive quality at the end of this work. The script I'm writing right now, another Gallico novel, The Love of Seven Dolls, has a horrible, terrible nemesis in it. And slowly you begin to reveal why he's like this, why he can't stand there to be anything pure and he has to corrupt everything. And there's a reason why. And when you find out that reason why, when you find out what that villain's Achilles heel is, it's not just a way to kill them, it's a way to understand them and empathize with them.
Well, like in perfect example, Thanos, he just wants to, it's overpopulation. It's too much overpopulation in the world. My solution he's not wrong. How he approaches it is wrong. And that's where the villainous aspect is to these characters. But it's not like the olden twisting the mustache to be bad just for be bad. There's no depth there. And that's what drives a good story. James, I could keep talking to you for at least 2-3 more hours, but I'm just going to ask you a few questions I ask all my guests, and then I will leave you on to write more things.
All the answers are in here.
Okay.
www.heartchart.com. USISA20 is your discount code.
What three screenplays should every screenwriter read?
Wow. Shawshank.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Man After My Own Heart.
Probably Godfather 1.
Mm-hmm. Great.
And not just a transcript of the movie, but you get, get the published screenplay. I'm trying to think. Probably Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah, another great one.
The characters, not the plot. The characters. Yeah. I'm proud of some of the stuff I've written, but
if someone
I actually read I actually have George Lucas's first American Graffiti script. We were supposed to try to finance it for him. Godfather 1, Shawshank. I would read some TV episodes too. I'd read some of Vince's episodes of Breaking Bad to show you what you can do in 45 to 50 pages.
The pilot is a genius work. Yeah. If someone's going to read one of your screenplays, if you're like, you can only read one of my scripts, which one is it?
I'd read Dracula.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Yeah. I love Dracula.
I don't know how it exists in some form or not, because we did all that extra work. Also, the August Rush script, I'm real proud of. Mm-hmm. August Rush was the last time I worked with Robin. And I thought Kirsten did such a good job directing that film, and it didn't get the acknowledgement that it should have, because I should have put Once Upon a Time. It's a screenplay where I used everything I knew about the heart chart, everything I knew about character, everything I knew about structure is in that film. And to me, there's a talk about a satisfying ending. Some people are not satisfied because they don't see them together, but for me, it's incredibly satisfying. He accomplished his goal. He brought his parents together. Yeah. And I can watch it 100 times, and it still gets me every time I get to that part.
Now, what advice would you give a screenwriter trying to break into the business today?
Well, the business has completely changed. I mean, it's wide open for writers the way it wasn't for me when I started out. Blacklist, Inkwell, Austin Film Festival screenplay contests, all of the fellowships that are being offered through Nichols and through Warner Brothers and Disney, and the International Screenwriters Association, I think, are wonderful.
ISA, yep.
I've done a lot of work for them. Screencraft, Stage 32. These are all platforms that didn't exist when we were trying to start out. There was no helping hand. The Austin Film Festival is worth submitting to. Keep submitting. Your scripts are now being read. They're not just going into a black hole. They're actually being read. You know, you've got 200 readers on the blacklist that are there to find scripts. That's their job, for their producers, their studios, their networks. They're there looking. That's how my daughter got her first film made, was through the blacklist. You know, she just directed her fourth film at Amazon. I'm Your Woman is Julia Hart. You know, Stargirl is Julia Hart. Plus the business is looking for the new threshold writers. They had it with me. You know, they don't want to put up with us anymore. They want the new, fresh voices who are coming out of not necessarily film schools, but coming out of workshops and master classes. And we didn't have that access. You've also got 100 more buyers than we had.
Oh, 1,000 probably. Yeah.
And it'll change. The COVID thing will come and go. Not that it's going to go, but we'll find a way to live with it. And we're already trying to get into production. As soon as production starts and some of that development moves off the shelf, they're looking.
Okay.
And I think it's a great time to be a writer, especially in TV, where finally that it is true. The writer has the power in television. You know, they used to say that, and then, but now it's true.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
To listen.
Okay.
You know, that's what I learned that from Francis and a few other people, to never speak first in the meeting, and listen to everything they have to say, and nod your head a lot and go, that's a good idea. Well, think about that. Make notes, and then go back. And Francis just said, even if you disagree with everything they said, you know, you go back and you look at your notes, and the ones that keep haunting you, the ones that keep coming back and biting you in the ass, those are the ones you have to address. Yeah. But I think listening is the listen and collaborate.
And where can
if you don't want to collaborate, go sculpt, or, you know, right. Go do a painting. You know, if you're not able to collaborate, you're going to have a hard time.
And where can people find more about the heart chart and everything you do?
Heartchart.com is the website. You'll find on there. We just put up our 4 master classes that we filmed in Austin last year. They're available for a special bundle. The toolkit is there for a download, which I'm going to send you one, good sir.
Thank you, sir. I look forward to that.
And the chart is a monthly subscription. You can get in and out anytime you want to. It's $8.99 a month. but I recommend that everybody sort of spend time with the toolkit before they try the heart chart. It's a great tool. I've just had, just in this last week, we had like another 30 or 40 subscriptions based on the last masterclass that I did. And we're updating the story mapping tool all the time. You get a 2-week free trial. You can go in and play with the examples and see what the other films that we have there. Like us on Facebook, like us on Twitter. And I will be doing some more classes, some online classes, in 2021.
Sounds good. Yeah. James, thank you so much for taking the time out to share your story, share your information. And talking to our tribe. So I truly appreciate it. And thank you for all the good work you've done through your career and continuing.
Now you've got to do what you told me you're going to do. Now you know about the heart chart. So.
Oh, yeah. I'll be talking about it. Don't worry about it.
Send you your thing. Now, this is a great, and I think what you guys are doing are great. The podcast is a whole other network that we never had access to. So I appreciate the exposure. Last thing, just remember when you're down and out on yourself that nobody, no director, no writer, no actor, no producer, no costume designer, no DP, nobody has a job in this business until a writer types the end. So that's the best advice I can give you is go type the end.
Thank you, James. I want to thank James so much for coming on the show and dropping those knowledge bombs on the Bulletproof Screenwriting Tribe. James, thank you so much. You are an inspiration. And if you guys want to take a closer look at the heart chart and everything that James has to offer, please head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/094. And don't forget, guys, to take advantage of this Black Friday sale. These prices will not be down this low again for a long, long time. So definitely take advantage. Up to 50 to 70% off the amazing courses at IFH Academy. So head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/Black Friday. Thank you guys so much. As always, keep on writing no matter what. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.